Did y'all hear the children?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's awesome.
Yes.
I love those sounds. Okay, we're going to do 1 Samuel chapter 14, starting with verse 24. That's where we're at tonight. We're going to work to the end of the chapter. 1 Samuel chapter 14, starting at verse 24. Okay, if I was to give, I don't normally do this, but if I was to give this teaching a title, this is the title I would give it: When Crazy is in Charge.
Yeah.
Okay, now, what happens, beloved, when crazy's in charge?
Yeah, did you say 24?
Verse 24.
Okay.
What happens when crazy's in charge?
Chaos.
Yeah. Nothing good. Yeah. Okay, so we're going to... This is the beginning of Saul, the first king of Israel, coming unwound. And we're going to watch this take place. It's really sad as we move through what is some of the flaws of his character that began to show up and become a real problem, not just for him, but for others. Okay. Here's where we are in the story. Jonathan picked a fight with some Philistines. Philistines were the people nearest the children of Israel who stood against God and his people. They sought to enslave them or kill them and plunder their resources. So Jonathan picks a fight with them in a group of Philistines where it was 10 to 1. Him and his armor bearer, we called him Arby, fought 20. Approximately 20 Philistines, 10 to 1. And not only did he win that battle, but it started a rout for the whole Philistine army. All this was done while Saul sat in the shade, focused on his comfort, while trying to avoid combat. And so in this chapter, one of the things that you should walk away with is the stark contrast between Saul the king and Saul and Jonathan his son. God brings deliverance through Jonathan. In other words, he gives deliverance to the people of Israel. He sets them free. That's what deliverance means. He sets them free from their oppressors and their enslavers. And now the Philistines are on the run. And that's where we join the story at verse 24. Verse 24 in my version says this: Now the men of Israel were hard pressed on that day. Now what they're doing is they're chasing after the Philistines. For Saul had put the people under oath, saying, Cursed be the man who eats food before evening and until I have avenged myself on my enemies. And so none of the people tasted food. Now, the word hard-pressed here can be translated in distress. I think NIV translates it that way. It means to be pressed very hard or crushed. So, in other words, even though they have routed the Philistines who've been their oppressors, the people are still experiencing oppression. Why? Well, we're told because Saul has forced them into a fast as an oath or as a promise to God. Now, first of all, let's just consider this. Can you imagine with me the amount of energy required for hand-to-hand combat? I can't imagine it. I literally cannot imagine it. I know a lot of soldiers, even before combat or during combat, their adrenaline is so high that they throw up. And the result of that is that's loss of fuel for their body to burn and continue to be able to function well. And so you can imagine that in this combat, the very same thing happened. But what has happened is Saul has oppressed his people. He's hard-pressed them or put them in a place of distress because he's not let them eat as a fast to God. But it's forced. He's forcing them out of fear. He says this: cursed be the man who eats food before evening. Now, the word curse simply means if you don't do what I'm telling you to do, then you are subject to death. And so I'm like, oh my gosh, well, you know, if I take just one bite of bread, I could die because of that, okay? And we see in what Saul says, we see that the fast really isn't for God. It is for Saul himself. Notice that it says, until I have avenged myself on my enemies. There's three references to himself. Now, some versions only have two. Until I have avenged, on my enemies. But the three times we're told that in the Hebrew, three times he references himself. So this is about him. This fast is really an attempt to manipulate God. It's not about God avenging these people. It's not about facing God's enemies. This is about Saul being avenged and being avenged on Saul's enemies. Now the people do what Saul wants them to do out of fear. I mean, okay, so now let me ask, what kind of leadership is it that causes people to follow them out of fear? We could use lots of words, but let me just say this. That is not godly leadership. It is not kingdom leadership. Saul is trying to look very spiritual, but his motivation is very selfish. Now let's pause for a second right here, and let's think about that. Saul is trying to look very spiritual, but his motivation is very selfish. Okay, beloved, am I, are you, guilty of trying to look more spiritual than you really are, than we really are? Do we sometimes do that? Do we sometimes try to manipulate God, and maybe we also try to manipulate others in order to look good in the eyes of those that are around us, or to get something that we really think we deserve? Do we sometimes care more about outward actions than we do inward conditions? Trying to look good spiritually, but all that being motivated by selfish reasons. Are we that way sometimes? Now, verses 25 through 31, I'm just going to read them to you. I know you can read. I'm not trying to treat you like kindergarten people, but read along with me. All the people of the land entered the forest, and there was honey on the ground. Now, let me pause just real quick to say, first of all, for honey to be on the ground means that there's a lot of honey there. Okay. Second of all, what I would want you to notice is that, isn't it interesting that where they enter the forest, God is providing food for them? Isn't that interesting? Okay, verse 20 says, when the people entered the forest, behold, there was a flow of honey, but no man put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. There's the leadership that's oppressive. Verse 27, but Jonathan had not heard when his father put the people under oath. Therefore, he put out the end of the staff that was in his hand and dipped it in the honeycomb and put his hand to his mouth, and his eyes brightened. Now, that's just a way of saying that his strength and energy was refreshed. Okay. Okay, verse 28. Then one of the people said, your father strictly put the people under oath, saying, cursed be the man who eats food today. And the people were weary. Now pay attention to that word. Then Jonathan said, my father has troubled the land. See now how my eyes have brightened because I've tasted a little of this honey. How much more if only the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies which they found. For now the slaughter among the Philistines has not been great. In other words, what he's saying there is that we would have carried out this mission much greater if we had been allowed to eat. But instead, what has happened is my father has weakened the people. Okay. Verse 31, they struck among the Philistines that day from Michmash to that word, to wherever that town was, and the people were not just weary now, they're very weary. Okay. Now, beloved, I want to go back through that and just mention a few things. Now, since this is Saul's fast and not God's fast, we see God provide food for the people. But what is going on is an outward conformity with no regard for the inward conditions. Saul wants the men to conform to this, but he doesn't care about what their lives really need. Now, by the way, let me say, an outward conformity with no regard for inward condition, that is a definition of legalism. Legalism is an outward conformity with no regard for inward condition. Legalism is mostly concerned about outward compliance, and it's not much concerned with the state of one's heart. Legalism typically does not focus on what God is doing. In other words, there wasn't any ability to access what God was doing here in the forest because legalism was in operation. It's not a focus on what God is doing, but on how you are keeping the rules. That's the focus. Legalism is man-made. It's man-made rules. It is manufactured spirituality. You ever met anybody with that? I've met many people who have manufactured spirituality. They're the kind of people that when you go through the front door, you're already in the backyard. You understand what I'm saying? There's not much substance to them. There's a lot of rule keeping. There's not a lot of heart. Saul is imposing legalism on all the people except. Look at verse 29. Verse 27. But Jonathan had not heard when his father put the people under oath, and therefore, and what he does is he eats the honey. Now, as he's eating, someone as they're marching through the forest, going through the forest looking for Philistines, one of the other soldiers explains to Jonathan, hey, you know, your dad said not to do that or you will die. And so here's something I think. How in the world, now Jonathan didn't hear what Saul had said because he was in combat some other place. And so when he joined the men and they're, you know, pursuing the Philistines, before someone said anything to him about them not being able to eat, he had to notice that none of them were taking advantage of any of the plunder. None of them were reaching down and grabbing bread or whatever other kind of food was left behind by the Philistines. And he had to notice that no one was taking part in the honey. So he had to know, but he goes ahead and takes part in the honey. So Saul has put everyone under legalism except Jonathan. Jonathan refuses to be put there. Also notice that one of the fruits of legalism, we'll come back and name a bunch of these, but one of the fruits of legalism, verse 28. This guy's telling Jonathan what his father has said, and then that verse ends with this, and the people were weary. Now, I'll tell you, legalism will wear you out. It's what legalism does is it makes Christianity a lot of work. It'll wear you out. You'll become weary in your spiritual walk if legalism is a part of what you're doing. Okay, and in verse 29, then Jonathan responds, he says, my father has troubled the land. That just means that my father has stirred up trouble. That's what it means. In other words, he hasn't been helpful. He's really created more problems than is necessary. And he says, see how my eyes have brightened because I tasted a little of the honey. And how much more could we have done what our mission was to do if he had allowed us to eat? That's verse 30. In other words, what he's saying is because of what my father has done, he has weakened the people of God. And I'll tell you, legalism does weaken your spiritual life because it disconnects you from God and reconnects you to rules. And then verse 31 ends with very weary. And then let me just continue just a little bit and then we'll come back and talk some about legalism. By the way, the reason why I want to talk about legalism is because I think legalism is rampant among the body of Christ. I really do. I would challenge you to go to Mardell's. I love Mardell's. I've spent a lot of money at Mardell's, okay? But I'll challenge you to go to Mardell's and see how many. Just take a shelf. Take a shelf. And count how many books are there on that shelf that tell you what you need to be doing, which is works, which is legalism, and how many books they are telling you what God is doing. I think what you'll find is an overwhelming number of books that'll tell you what you should be doing. And I'm saying to you that, beloved, I believe legalism is rampant among us. And the only thing I'm wanting to really do is to raise your awareness about it. I'm not saying that you need to go do anything. That would be me casting legalism on you. I don't want to do that. You know, if anything, what you need to be doing is allowing God to give examination to your own heart and see where legalism has subtly snuck in to your walk with Jesus. Verses 32 through 35, what happens is that the men are so hungry that when evening comes, verse 32, they rush upon the spoil, the sheep, oxen, and calves, and they slay them on the ground, and then they began to eat the meat with its blood. Now, that in Deuteronomy was a no. Deuteronomy, God says, no, do not eat meat with blood. And the reason for that is because the blood is considered the life of the creature. And the life belongs to God, not to you and me. So you are not to consume the blood. And any time they properly sacrificed an animal on an altar, they would sacrifice that animal in such a way that it properly bled the animal so that the meat was not full of blood. So they're sinning is what's happening. Okay. Now notice legalism promotes sin. Notice that. Then they told Saul, verse 33, behold, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood. And he said, you have acted treacherously. Roll a great stone to me today. And it says, Saul dispersed yourselves among the people and say to them, each one of you, bring me his ox or his sheep and slaughter it here and eat. Do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood. And so all the people that night brought each one his ox with him and slaughtered it there on that altar. And what that stood for was that they were properly killing the animal so that it could bleed the most. I suspect, this is just Scott Latham now, this is not any Bible scholar, but I suspect that there probably was a bonfire close by and that they probably cooked the meat as well. Okay. And then in verse 35 it says, and Saul built an altar to the Lord. This is what the rock was supposed to be. And then we get this comment. It was the first altar that he'd built to the Lord. Wow. This is the first one. Okay. All right. Let's talk a little bit about legalism. And then we're going to talk a little bit about why is this mentioned that this is the first altar that Saul has built. Okay. Legalism is performance-based. Legalism causes you to focus on how well you're doing and not paying too much attention about how well God is doing. It's based on my performance, so that you're constantly evaluating how you're doing in your Christian walk. How well am I? How much am I reading my Bible? How many times am I praying? How long am I praying? How often am I praying? Am I talking to other people about Jesus? It's a constant evaluation. Now, all those things are great, but if that's your focus, there's something wrong. Legalism says rules come before relationship. In other words, you've got to keep the rules if you want relationship. That, beloved, is absolutely counter to the gospel. I want you to notice the fruits of legalism. And as I mentioned these, beloved, I'm wanting you to think about, okay, is any of this in me? Okay. And I'm just going to walk through, like when at the very beginning, cursed is the man who takes food before the evening. Okay, they were hard pressed. That's verse 24. One of the fruits of legalism is a sense of crushing the life out of you. It may start really well. You may be able to think, man, I'm so disciplined, and look at all the things that I'm being able to check off. But the end result of that is that it will continue to take life from you until you feel crushed. Legalism often promotes manipulation. It's like, God, if I do this, then I want you to do this for me. Or, Lord, since I want you to do this, I'll do this and this and this. And all that is just bargaining. That's all that is. And that often leads to trying to manipulate others as well. Legalism promotes self-focus. In other words, if it's based on my performance and I'm constantly evaluating how I'm doing, what is the focus? What is my focus? It's me. You know, legalism follows the unhealthy, the unholy trinity. Me, myself, and I. And legalism wears people out. It makes them weary and it weakens their spiritual life. And if you're sensing that in yourself, if you sense, my Christian life just wears me out, then you might need to do some examination. Have I bought into some rules living? Have I bought into some performance-based living? Am I really living by grace? Am I really living in the love of Jesus for me? It stirs up trouble. You know, Jonathan said, my father's troubling the land. Legalism stirs up trouble between people. It draws lines. Like, okay, listen, you're not keeping these rules, so you're not doing as well as I am. Well, how dare you say that to me? Just because I'm not keeping your rules, because it divides people. It causes trouble between people. And then finally, it promotes sin. Because the men had fasted all day, when evening came, what they did is they rushed upon the plunder of animals that had been left by the Philistines, and they just killed them and started eating the meat raw, full of blood. It encouraged them to sin. I mean, think about this. You know, if I tell you don't, what's the first thing you want to do? You want to do. That's right. Legalism promotes sin. So, okay, are you following rules or are you following a rabbi, beloved? First and foremost, are you following rules or are you following a rabbi? Is your spiritual life driven by keeping rules or by keeping relationship with Jesus? Now, beloved, I'm not saying rules are always wrong. I'm not saying rules are always bad. They should never be first. Relationship above all else. In verse 35, and Saul built an altar to the Lord. It was the first altar that he built to the Lord. Now, why are we being told this? Why is this important for us to know? And I think it's because this should have been the first thing Saul did as a king, was build an altar to the Lord. That should have been one of the first things that he did. But it's not. It's now coming. He's doing it now, you know, when it's an opportune time for him to look very spiritual. In other words, it probably wasn't a priority for Saul to do. It might have been among his priorities, but it wasn't first priority. What priority is God in your life, beloved? Does God's value go up and down like the stock market in your life? Or does he stay priority one no matter what? Is God among your priorities? Or is he your top priority always? Okay, in verse 36 anyway, Saul says, okay, now let's continue to pursue the Philistines. It's so interesting in this verse. You know, he's made the men go all day without food. And now what he's suggesting is that we go all night without sleep. I mean, all that is a lack of consideration for the people that he's leading. That is a bad leader, beloved. Kingdom leadership is not like that. In a minute, I'm going to talk about kingdom leadership. Okay. So then they say, he says, let's do this. And what the priest says is, okay, well, let's pray about it. Let's seek the Lord first. In verse 37, shall I go down? Saul inquires of God, shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you give them into the hand of Israel? And then we're told this, God does not answer him on that day. Basically, Saul says, my prayer is not answered, so whose fault is that? And it just blows my mind that Saul doesn't even give any kind of consideration of doing some self-examination at this point. He blames it on everyone else. That's like me coming up to you and saying, listen, yesterday I prayed this prayer and it wasn't answered. And I just want you to know it's your fault. That's ridiculous, isn't it? That's ridiculous. He gives no thought that he might be the one sinning. Now, before you consider someone else's sin, beloved, make sure that you spend time considering yours first. Okay? Will you do that? In other words, in Matthew chapter 7 and in Luke chapter 6, Jesus says this, take the log out of your own eye and then address the speck in another's eye. Do that first. In verse 39, Saul makes another oath. He made one in verse 24 that started the whole story. But now in verse 39, He makes another oath. He says, draw here all you chiefs of the people and investigate. See how this sin has happened today. In other words, I know there's sin out there among you guys. You guys, there's a sinner out there somewhere. Go find him. That's what he's saying. He says, draw, and then he says, for as the Lord lives. Now that's an oath language. He's making another oath. This is his second oath. As the Lord lives, who delivers Israel, though it is in Jonathan, my son, in other words, Jonathan, God, Lord used Jonathan to just do that. He, even if it's Jonathan, he will surely die. Okay, but not anyone answered him. Everybody's going like, Jonathan's the one that ate the honey, but I'm not saying anything, you know. Okay. Okay, so this is his second oath, and so the end result is what they decide to do is they decide to cast lots, okay? Verse 40 says to all Israel, you shall be on one side, and Jonathan and I, my son, will be on the other side. And the people said to Saul, do what seems good to you. And so then what they do is they cast lots. And casting lots is like rolling dice. And so it's just real simple. It's like, They roll this thing and it points to either was it someone among the men or was it Saul and Jonathan, okay? And so you can see Saul completely expecting it to be pointing to the men. And so when they roll it and it points to Saul and Jonathan, you can see Saul going, what? And then what he does is he says, okay, cast the lots again, okay? And this time, it's in my version, it says, and Jonathan was taken. First time, it says, Saul and Jonathan were taken by the lots. In other words, it pointed to them and the people escaped. They were dismissed from the problem. They are not the problem. The problem is somewhere between Jonathan and Saul. And so they cast lots between Jonathan and Saul, and it says Jonathan was taken. In other words, it pointed to him. And then verse 43, Saul said to Jonathan, "Tell me what you have done." So Jonathan told him and said, "I indeed tasted a little honey with the end of the staff that was in my hand. Here I am. I must die." In other words, go ahead and kill me for doing that. Okay, that's what he's saying. Okay. And so then verse 44, now we have the third oath, the third promise that Saul makes. "May God do this to me and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan." Notice he doesn't say, "Jonathan, my son." He just says, "Jonathan." Okay. Now, I want you to notice in verse 41, "Therefore Saul said to the Lord, the God of Israel, give a perfect lot." That's my version. What does another version say there? Verse 41. "He said to the Lord God, give a perfect lot." That's my version. Can you find it? Verse 41. Huh? Here's what mine says. Verse 41, this is what mine says. "Therefore Saul said to the Lord, the God of Israel, give a perfect lot."
Why have you not answered your servant today?
Okay, that's very good. Now, what Saul is doing is he's saying, God, give the truth. That's what he's saying, okay? Now, show the truth, okay? But notice, Saul is commanding God. Now, what does that say about Saul? He says, in other words, Saul is at times completely out of touch with who God really is. By the way, beloved, it's not a good idea to give God commands. Okay? It's okay to receive God's commands, but it's not a good idea to give God commands. God doesn't have any... God didn't have anything to say, and so he thinks it's sin in the community. And so, listen, let me just give you some advice. When God doesn't say anything to you, you're seeking God and he doesn't answer you, and your community doesn't have an answer for you either. Notice the men didn't say anything when he said, "Okay, who sinned?" And everybody's going, Okay. All right, so when God doesn't bring you an answer and your community doesn't have an answer, my best advice to you is to stay put right where you are. Don't move. Stay there. Don't move forward. And at that point, begin to exercise what is called weight training. W-A-I-T. Weight training. Wait on the Lord. Now, beloved, if you don't know this already, waiting on the Lord is some of the hardest. It's one of the hardest things you'll ever have to do. Because when you wait on the Lord, you're losing all control. You're giving Him all control. Which, that's the way it ought to be anyway. But as you lose control, it is painful. Waiting on the Lord is one of the hardest things that will be asked of you to do. But I guarantee you, just like weight training, W-E-I-G-H-T, weight training, makes you stronger, so does weight, W-A-I-T, training, makes you spiritually stronger. Okay, rather than look at his own life as the possible problems, Saul would rather kill his own son. Now, let me pause here to say, are we guilty of that in some measure as well sometimes? Do we sometimes let something die or willing to kill something off in order to not admit the truth? In other words, are we willing to let a relationship die or a goal die or a piece of our character die in order to not admit what the truth is? Are we willing to do that sometimes? In other words, it's more important to stand in the light, regardless of what the light might reveal, than to let part of your life die. But Saul wasn't there. Saul was more willing to kill something than admit the truth. And also notice that Saul gives three oaths. He makes three vows. He makes three promises in our passage. When someone is making promises all over the place, they are trying to look bigger and better than they really are. That's really what they're trying to do. Beloved, be careful with your promises. Diana rarely made promises. I can remember, and she did that on purpose. She was very intentional about making her promises, and she rarely made them. I can remember one of the kids arguing with her one day, and they said, "You promised!" And she said, "No, I didn't." And there was no more argument because everybody in the room knew that she rarely makes a promise. And when she does, when she did, it was a big, big deal. The reason for that was Diana rarely promised because she never wanted to promise and not back it up. So she was very careful about her promises. The result of that was is that she never had to work to look better. She never had to look bigger than she was. She was who she was. And that was big enough and best enough, being the real her. Be leery of people who make lots of promises. Now, the promise, though well intentioned, you know, when someone's making lots of promises, the promise may be well intentioned. But if they're making lots of promises, then typically what's going on is the promise is really very empty and not real. Now, in verse 45, we're coming to the close of our story tonight. The men step forward and defend Jonathan. Saul says, "Okay, you're going to die." In other words, he makes an oath. "May God do to me this to me and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan." The men step up and say, "Not on my watch. God just delivered us through Jonathan. That's just not going to happen." And Saul has to comply to what the men say. In other words, Saul has lost his authority and his loyalty because his leadership was all about himself and not about the people who he led. And that's the huge difference between the worldly leadership and kingdom leadership. Kingdom leadership is this: to lead for the benefit of those you lead, even if you have to lay your life down for their benefit. That's exactly what Jesus did. Exactly. Kingdom leadership is leading for the benefit of those that you lead, even if it means laying your life down. Worldly leadership is get all you can out of people. Promote yourself as much as you can. Take advantage all you can. Because it's all about me. It's not about the people I lead. Now verses 47 through 52 at the very end, it's all about Saul. One of the things I want you to notice in verse 47, it says, "Now when Saul had taken the kingdom." Now that's the same word they used about taking lots. When lots were cast, it said Saul and Jonathan were taken. And then when it was cast between Saul and Jonathan, it says Jonathan was taken. It's the exact same word that was used. You know, it's a subtle hint that Saul is taking charge. He has taken the kingdom. It is now his. It's not God's. And also notice what happens. In verse 47, his kingdom becomes widespread. It impacts Moab and Ammon and Edom and Zobah and the Philistines and even the Amalekites. It becomes very widespread. But we will see as we read the story of Saul on and on that even though this is Saul's kingdom and it's becoming wider and wider, it is very, very shallow. It may be 10 miles wide, but it's only 2 inches deep. In other words, this was a kingdom that was satisfied with superficial. There was really no depth to it. And beloved, real life can never be sustained with shallow living. Real life requires roots and depth. In the parable of the sower, Jesus tells the story of these four different soils that seed was cast on. And one of those was seed that landed on soil that was just on top of rock. And because it couldn't send down its roots, it burst forth and sprouts real quickly. But when the sun comes out, it burns and dies. And that's what happens with real life. Is that what happens is that because there's no depth, because life is only being lived on shallow surfaces, because there's a satisfaction with being superficial, what happens is burnout happens all the time. Colossians 2, verse 6 and 7 says this, "Therefore, as you have received Christ Jesus the Lord, so walk in Him, having been firmly rooted, and now being built up in Him and established in your faith, just as you were instructed, and overflowing with gratitude." Let me ask you, beloved, are you doing that? Are you sending your roots deep? Are you letting the Lord establish you? In other words, are you growing up? Are you maturing? In other words, if I could talk to the 10-year-old you when you knew Jesus when you were 10, would I find a great difference when I came back and talked to you now, at your age now? Has there been growth? Has there been depth? Have you sent your roots deeply? Are you letting Him establish you, mature you, grow you up? Well, this is our lesson for tonight. Your small group leaders have questions ready for you. I hope you have a great discussion, and thanks for being here tonight.